Caution. Learning in progress.
Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for listening to another episode of Smarter Every Season. My name is Tyler Hubert. I'm a member of the product support team here at Precision Planning. That is the group that traditionally organizes and puts together a lot of your podcast episodes. Sometimes we're the content experts. Sometimes the product support team is not. Today is one of the days we are. I hope my guests today, which are Hans Stutzman.
Hello.
And Clay Scott.
Hey.
Like that I just said we and kind of lump myself in with your expertise on the topic today.
We'll take you as one of the experts.
I don't know if that says more about my technical capabilities or your judgment, Hans. But we're going to talk about hydraulics today. What we've traditionally done in the past this time of year is try to think through what are a couple topics we can talk about to really prepare guys for the busy season. Now, actually, as it turns out, in a week or so here, we're going to start to get into our weekly cadence of the every week episodes to kind of bring you spring updates. But March, we've kind of traditionally tried to think through what are some things, what are some challenges that we can talk about as we head into spring that kind of puts our technicians or our dealers in the right mindset. If you may remember a couple years ago, I think we talked about asking better questions.
Yep.
That's been more than a couple years because I think
Paul was that one.
Yeah. Three or four.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've talked about asking better questions, listening. I know there have been some other technical ones we've gotten into in the past, but nevertheless, we're going to talk hydraulics today. And the goal with this episode is to kind of give some of our technicians out there a little bit better of an understanding or working foundational knowledge around tractor and planter hydraulics. Clay, this is actually something you tackled this at technical training this year.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we're going to try and overlap with some of that material, but hopefully kind of give some folks some fresh stuff on this too.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, gentlemen, it seems like you're ready. So let me go ahead and jump into question one, more of a theory and foundational education question here. Finish this sentence. Pressure is to hydraulics what blank is to electrical theory.
Voltage.
I love how you looked at each other, even though you both know the answer.
Yeah, we just kind of got to figure out who's going to say what here.
Yeah. So.
Can you explain that to me?
Yeah. So my approach on it would be your voltage is basically your pressure. It is the hotness or the force behind it. Your GPM or your amps is what's actually doing the work on the system. So if you think of it in a voltage scenario, your amps equates to gallons per minute, and your voltage is equating to pressure.
The way it's been explained to me before, too, and this kind of makes some sense to me, is pressure is the ability to do work. It doesn't necessarily mean that work's being done. Mm-hmm. So you can have pressure. Think about a valve. You can have pressure behind a valve, but if the valve's closed, nothing's happening. There's no flow.
Correct.
It's all potential energy at that point.
Good. Yeah, good. No, that's a good way to put it. So then to me, if I have GPM, GPM is what's actually doing my work. I would equate that then to like amperage.
Correct.
In an electrical system.
Correct.
Okay, good deal. Okay, that gives
us. And that's true whether that's hydraulics, or whether that's liquid systems, whether that's voltage systems. All of them are roughly the same principles. We just basically interchange the terms.
GPM is what is, I was going to say it's what is moving things, but like pressure can move things.
But you can't have things being done without something moving. And the only way you get something moving is when you have GPM.
That's a good point. Okay, good deal. That gives us a good foundation here to start from. I've got a couple other questions prepared. Here's something that I don't know if I fully have my mind around. I'm hoping you guys can help clarify. It's actually funny because when she started here, Freya Watson, who's a host on the podcast as well, first heard the term power beyond and made the joke, is this something that I should understand on a tractor, or is he talking about
something from church?
Is this a religious phrase? What is the purpose of a power beyond?
Yeah, so this is one that I feel like anytime it gets brought up, there's 15 different people in the room and 15 different opinions about what power beyond is meant to do. And I'm not necessarily going to get into what power beyond is meant to do, but I am going to talk about what it is really good at.
Good. I was hoping you would.
And yeah. what it's good at is moving a lot of hydraulic oil. It's a direct line off of the pump. So we're not going through any remotes if you come from the AGCO world, or SCVs if you come from the Deere side of things. It's not going through any sort of control device. It is straight to that coupler. So with that, there's no restrictions really. So it's really good at moving a lot of oil. So I typically try to use them in scenarios where it's going to consume a lot of oil. So things like motors, pumps, things like that, that we can really start to use a lot of oil, alternators, things like that, where we can really consume some oil. That's where I like to use them. Now, notice I did not say vac fans. The reason I say not vac fans is because we do not want those going to full pressure as soon as the tractor starts up. So I am selective in when I'm using it on a planter.
So we recommend a Power Beyond with Delta Force?
I wouldn't say we recommend, Clay. I'm going to jump in here. Clay, I probably more quickly would say that you could do it, use it with Delta Force. This is a little bit of preference on how we set some of the stuff up on there. It can be used with Delta Force, okay, is a good way of saying it. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I probably like about a Power Beyond, and there's two ways of using this, is, and now, and say, Clay, you can correct me if I'm jumping here, but there's the pressure side of a Power Beyond, and then there's the return side, which is what we can typically call a motor return, or something along those lines. Motor return, Power Beyond return are roughly the same thing. Mm-hmm. The nice part about a Delta Force in a return, if you're using a Power Beyond, is that you're returning back to pump as a free-flowing valve back to the sump side of the system. So you're not building return pressure. You also have nothing. If you disable something, if you shut the valve off, you can still flow return pressure back. So you're not going to overpressurize a planter if you lower the planter down and overpressurize a Delta Force cylinder or something like that. So there's good and bad to a Power Beyond system on that. The thing I really like about it is the return side of it.
Yep.
On a Power Beyond.
Versus if I use an SCV or a remote, I might have a hard close of a valve.
Correct.
When I do disable an SCV or remote.
Correct.
Basically what that means then is if I don't time that right, basically I have pressure, or it's harder for me to bleed off return pressure.
Yeah, what can happen is if you shut the valve off on Delta Force and then you're off doing something else and then you lower the planter down, you now have pressure against the both sides of the cylinder because you're pressurizing the cylinder because you're trying to push your row unit up and the cylinder valves are all locked. There's no place for that oil to go. So at that point, you can actually carry the entire bar on a cylinder pressure that's locked, that's at the SCV.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest concern I see with that's where I see value in the Power Beyond, is that it gives us a free flow back to tank at that point if you're using both sides of it. There's a whole host of issues on the front side of getting pressure to a Power Beyond, which is where we normally run into issues with it, which is where a lot of people struggle with it.
Yeah, explain that to me. The side of it of basically enabling it.
Yeah.
What do I need to do? Because I've been on enough phone calls to kind of understand a little bit more that if we recommend Delta Force goes into a Power Beyond, but then somebody calls us and says, I'm trying to do a health check, I don't have pressure, that a lot of times you have to enable another port that the Power Beyond almost mimics that pressure then. How? I'm not real sure. But I've been around long enough to know, okay, the next thing you need to do is this to get it to work. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, so essentially we just need something else running on that pump, particularly like in a two-pump tractor scenario. We need something else running off of that pump that is operating at high pressure. So whether that's a constant down, And I use that sparingly because sometimes constant down has like a low relief pressure and then it goes into a vac fan. So we just need something else on that circuit that's demanding high pressure, or we need to put a T in line and loop from the Power Beyond over to the load sense port, which is going to get us our full pressure that we need to operate with Delta Force. So... and that's, again, that's only in a Delta Force scenario. If we're running something like, if we did decide to maybe use vac fans on Power Beyond, which again, don't recommend, but it's a possibility.
That goes for me as well. I also don't recommend vac fans. That's not just a Clay statement. That's mine as well.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's a common thing, but I think Hans and I have seen enough pictures of pieces of vac impellers stuck into trees and CCS tanks and things like that. That
it's not a good day.
Yeah, we'll go on a side note here. We have a planner here that we use for the new dealer training planner. And when we were putting that together, we kind of came to the conclusion that we've got a lot of hands that are really close to the planner and a lot of folks that are really close to it when it's running. And we actually put a scatter blanket around the vac blower. Just like I said, there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen and people are really close to it. So we were gun shy enough that we thought we needed to do that. And I use that example not to tell you guys that you need to go put scatter blankets on your vac fans, but there's always a potential for things to go sideways.
Yeah.
So be very careful, especially with fans like that. That's a big piece of aluminum spinning really fast if it goes wide open.
How does it go wide open on a Power Beyond when you power up the tractor?
So if there's no flow controller, it's essentially getting as fast as or as much oil as that motor can take. It's going to consume it because it's high pressure oil, and it's just going to start turning that fan faster and faster and faster until it hits max RPM of the motor. There's no shortage of oil, and it's going to keep going in a scenario where we don't have a flow controller.
It's
going
to go as fast as the pump runs to.
Yeah.
So if the pump goes wide open, that vac fan's going to go wide open.
So. Typically, in my recall, too, Power Beyond is something that can be added to a tractor when you are out of SCV ports.
Mm-hmm. Sort of, yeah.
Okay, what do you mean?
So more or less, we need to have some sort of a variable displacement pump, so a load sensing system or a pressure compensated load sensing system.
We also refer to that typically as closed center?
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And the closed center versus open center is talking about the porting on the actual spools of the hydraulic valve itself. If we have a closed center style system, we can add Power Beyond in a lot of scenarios. We can, not always, but that's always an option if the tractor will support it. If the OEM had provisions for it, that we could add that is always a possibility.
And that's most new tractors that are built. I would say anything from 2000 on.
Yeah.
Would have something along those lines.
Yeah, anything. I mean, 2000 forward and really 200 horse and above is pretty much exclusively closed center. Yep. It's when we start getting into those. If you guys were training, the stuff that I talk about is when we're building planners for, you know, the FFA chapter or the university down the road or anybody that's doing small plot work like that. That's usually where we start running into issues of their tractor can't do it. They either have an older machine, they have maybe a lease machine that they got from a dealership that they're allowed to use, and it's not quite set up for what they're doing. That's usually when we run into those scenarios.
So you're actually onto something there, Clay, that I want to go a little bit deeper into, because there are instances, of course, where more and more componentry on the planner, I feel like, is hydraulic. And so it is easy to kind of run out of SCVs pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And not really know how to consolidate or what kind of things to tie together from a hydraulic standpoint. Take me through what is you guys' logic when you're adding a hydraulic component to a planner and trying to figure out how to plumb it. If I'm somebody that's not very experienced there, what are some things that I need to consider that you guys can coach on?
So I guess first thing is flow, total flow. Like what's each device that I'm trying to get into? What's it going to go into as far as flow? So you really want to know how many gallons am I trying to cram into out of one SCV. Good rule of thumb is that your SCV is going to max out around 25 gallons per minute. That's the high end of any SCV remote's going to really struggle anything above that. So you want to keep it down below that. So your flow rate, so GPM is what your biggest thing is, and then making sure you size all the hoses to accommodate for that. And then I like to think of it as what are the control pieces? So like a vac fans I generally try to keep kind of isolated away from everything else. I don't want something else messing with my vac fan pressure. I want that being very consistent. So if I had tied in with like a CD motor or something like that, I'm more likely to get some surging or movement on the vac fan system. But like a liquid system and delta force, those are prime opportunities to try and combine together. They're either running full flow or they're running their own dedicated valve, like a PWM control valve on them that's managing their flow consistently. So I try and group control things together a little bit, look at my controls and look at my flow rates and try and keep stuff separately. But vac fans, I try to keep as much, either keep vacs with vacs or keep vacs by themselves as much as possible. And then you throw in compressors, you throw in alternators, you throw in liquid pumps. Those are all good things to kind of tie together and pull together. Keep things out of a compressor. I don't have a problem on certain planers. I don't have a problem going into a raised lower circuit and tying in with a raised lower on like an Air Force compressor or something like that. There are certain planers that you can run in continuous down, and there's planers that you shouldn't run in continuous down. That's an OEM decision. Most deer planers, you can run in continuous down and not hurt them. Most Kinze planers, I would not recommend that. I would stay away from that. You're more likely to start blowing seals apart on a Kinze planer.
Okay, so this is good. Compressors.
Yep.
Before the lift manifold or off a face of the lift manifold?
So for me, I'm personally going to usually run anything that's switched. So liquid pumps, compressors, anything that's going to be turning on and off. Or consuming variable amounts of oil, that's what I'm going to put ahead of a valve block or a delta force block. Things like an alternator that are pretty continuous, pretty even, that's where I'm more interested in putting them on a delta force block.
So a seating motor would probably be more continuous. Typically, you're kind of setting a speed and rate in field.
Yeah. A lot of this gets into personal preference. There's a lot of things that will work. For me personally, I'm like alternator off the delta force block. That's all I want to run. Now, there's, like you said, something like a seating motor, pretty constant. You pretty much know where the RPMs are going to be. We'll be just fine.
Okay, so like a compressor, why? What's the risk?
For me, the it's not necessarily so much risk of, but just I guess it is a risk, but when that compressor kicks on, we're going to see a pressure drop, like we were talking earlier. We need more oil. We're going to see pressure fall off. For a brief moment, we could lose some delta force performance there. So for me, we could be maybe close to the high side of what that delta force block can flow. So if we're starting to get close to that, and then we start kicking things on and off, are we okay? Aren't we okay? We could be maybe starting to push the edge of where we should be at there. So that's why, like I said earlier, I like to have things that once we put hydraulics to it, it's going to run the whole time, and we can manage that a lot easier than things turning on and off.
So if I'm plumbing that compressor in from pressure and return from the tractor instead of going off a face, I'm less likely to starve a delta force system?
Right. So the way I think about that is we just have less things to flow through, right? We're not trying to force all that oil through a block. It's maybe a pump and a compressor that are tied together. We can run 3/4-inch hoses back to both of them, and we've got more than enough flow there. We'll be fine. The pump's going to, the tractor's going to account for that. We're going to be producing more oil than we need anyways.
Should be.
So it's just a little bit safer that way, in my opinion. I'll let Hans give his opinion because, like I said, this is very opinion based.
I generally tend to agree with Clay on this. This is kind of if you have a completely open face, you can do it. Yeah. But I personally like the idea of going off of teeing off the head of the block. It's just one less thing to really have. The block is still a control system. And you're kind of within the control system trying to pull things out of a control block. And I prefer just to be ahead of that and just getting untouched oil flow, I guess, at that point is the way I would say it. And it just decreases the issue, the chance that I could affect my delta force system by being in the block. That's a preference. It's just some years of experience that we've ran into where guys have tried to tie too many things off of a lift manifold face and cause issues, and so that's probably the biggest thing. I would more recommend guys to go to that and then make sure they watch where they plumb in delta force supply coming off the face going to the cylinders. Like, that's a big piece. Make sure you plumb that part correctly. We have recommendations on it. Don't try to go in through an end and run 22 rows off of one end going the other direction. Like, you got, there's a good reason why we have some recommendations on that. And whatever you do, do not plumb in something off of a cylinder on a delta force system. There's one place, if you want to tie into that delta force circuit, there's two places you can tie into it: right at the face or right before the block. Those are the two places. Anything else, you're asking for trouble.
If it's a compressor too, it should probably have a dedicated face, right?
I prefer a dedicated face if it's going to be a compressor.
Okay.
That's my preference.
Okay. Also, Clay, on the note of opinions, that's kind of why you're here. I mean, as a guy who kind of likes to give his opinion.
Well, generally unasked for, but I'm always glad to deliver.
Okay, this next question is one that I'm kind of interested to learn more, kind of personally. What generates heat in a hydraulic system? And the reason I want to ask this question is to try and better understand. In an instance where I get a high oil temp warning on a tractor, or my delta force block is hot enough you could fry an egg on it, what do I do? How can I? What I'm ultimately trying to get from you guys is how I can dissipate that. But let's first start with, how does heat get generated?
If you're bringing your own eggs, it's 50 cents a piece right now.
I'll make you a nice sausage egg sandwich right on that lift manifold, boys. Yeah, you can't be giving eggs away for free.
You
right
can't
now.
Give eggs away for free.
So, I mean, as far as where heat gets built up, heat is always coming from a restriction. So whether that's, you know, a delta force block is a restriction, a compressor is a restriction, an alternator is a restriction. They're all restrictions. However, those components don't make hot oil. They create heat, but they don't make hot oil.
Okay.
Bad plumbing, kinked lines, improper hose sizing, that is what makes hot oil. And also, before you go chasing anything on the precision planting side, go blow out the tractor coolers. As a tractor tech, that is something that it is so easy to point the finger towards whatever was added last to the planter, but a lot of times we're giving up a lot of performance on the front of the tractor. So keeping the tractor coolers clean is going to help mitigate a lot of that high temp stuff. That's something that we ran into day in and day out. Every service, we blew coolers out, and then we hot water washed every cooler every time we serviced a tractor. And we had a lot of guys running a lot of precision planting components. We didn't have trouble.
Clay, I'm going to delicately approach this question.
Yeah.
You blew out a lot of coolers.
Yeah.
What is the percentage of time that you, before you blew out a dirty cooler, you were told, no, it's good. It's clean. It should be fine.
Pretty high. Okay. I don't necessarily want to put a number to it, but I think there's a lot of growers out there that they do really good maintenance.
Yeah.
They stay up on oil changes. They grease things. They catch stuff before it's a problem. There's a lot of guys that catch that. But coolers are something that are overlooked all the time. And, you know, not so much here in the central Midwest as it is as you start to get farther, you know, up into maybe Minnesota, Wisconsin way, and then over towards the Ohio and the Northeast. What we saw, you know, dairy machines, tractors that ran triple mowers. Those things always have dirty coolers because they're kicking up pollen. They're kicking up all that chaff from the mowers. Those are always going to be dirtier machines. So anything like that that's maybe not just a field tractor, those are going to be the ones that are key ones to watch out for. And traditionally, you know, I don't want to rip on dairy folks because it's going to feel that way whenever I say this, but generally speaking, tractors from dairies had more trouble, and there's just a lot more particulate in the air.
They're used more. They probably have more hours than a normal grain operation is. They're going to have more stuff flying around.
Yeah,
it's just the nature of the beast.
It could be strictly on the grain side of a dairy operation, but even so, there's still going to be a lot more particulate in the air that those tractors are picking up every day when they're just moving around. So those are the ones that I always try to watch out for.
Clay, I think to add to that comment just a little bit, one thing I think of is grab your laser temp gun and actually just go check the cooler. That's one of the first things. If your guy calls and says, hey, I'm getting hot hydraulics, okay, first thing we're going to do is we're going to go to the cooler and we're going to go to the inlet tent and we're going to get a temp there and we're going to go to the outlet and see how much that cooler is actually dropping.
Yep.
That's a diagnostic in field once we've already gotten to the point of it. But
yep,
that's the first thing. And then to see how much, like what you're getting. Clay, you do agree 70 degrees is a decent?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on ambient and operating temps, but yeah, I mean, you don't want to see 10 degrees getting pulled out of it, you know, from one side to the other. There's a problem. That's there. A problem. We're not pulling enough heat out. And one thing we talked about, you know, in training with a couple of the groups when it got brought up was coolers, on the planter. And so I did a little research on it and I don't want to make any big recommendations here because we're not going to really go down the path of Precision's probably never going to sell these. We're never really going to have instructions for it or anything like that. But just doing some quick looking on Grainger, they've got different options there for $1,000 to $1,500. You can add a cooler with a fan. It comes as a package deal. They can handle 200 PSI, so that has to go on the return circuit. And like we talked earlier about using Power Beyond, that's an option there. We really need to make sure that's going into a Power Beyond return circuit. We don't want any sort of a chance that they can
reverse the flow
and blow that cooler up, because it will pop. There's no doubt in my mind that they will blow up. So
that'll be a geyser of 3/4-inch lines shooting oil anywhere you want to go with it. It's a real quick way to get 300 gallon or get 50 gallons of oil on the ground.
Yeah.
So would my strategy be maybe my component, I believe, is causing high heat. I put that into Power Beyond, and that's what I put my aftercooler on.
So realistically, I mean, you can put it, you know, some of those ones that I was looking at, I forget what the flow through them was, but it was pretty high. They've got inch fittings on the sides. So in a lot of cases, I'm not, you know, if Brent Wessels is listening, I'm not saying, Brent, you can go put your 72 row all through here, but I'm saying most planters can probably push all the oil back through one of those coolers. If it's got inch fittings, you can probably put all the oil that's coming off that planter through there. So I have no problem telling guys, hey, make yourself a little manifold and run your Delta Force, your alternator, and maybe a liquid pump. Tie all that return into one and run it all back through that cooler and run it all back through the Power Beyond. That's absolutely an option. Now, I say that with some caveats there, because there's some tractors that feed Power Beyond return oil directly into the pump pickup. Yep. So that's never making it to a cooler. So make sure that if we're going down that route, we need to make sure it's actually going into tank, not back into the charge side of the going back into the pickup of the charge pump.
Okay. I've got one more question, but I want to ask this too. You had mentioned basically efficient plumbing or inefficient plumbing, mm-hmm. kind of being a way that generates heat.
Yep.
What can I look for to make sure I'm not plumbing things inefficiently? Like, I want to be kind of careful with that question. I'm not trying to call out anybody's plumbing work, but
right.
Is there a rule of thumb that, like, generally I'm kind of trying to make sure I don't do XYZ? Anything we can pass on there?
Yeah. For me, one of the big things is I like to have big hoses running from the back of the planter up to wherever I'm returning to. So avoiding the smaller, like avoiding a bundle of small hoses that are all running up to, like all running up to a small T where we put it into the coupler. Let's get all those small hoses fed at the back of the planter. Let's get all those plumbed together and then run a single sort of a trunk line back to the tractor. That way we have a lot more flow ability back to the tractor. We're not trying to push all that oil through small hoses back a long distance.
I agree with that. Like, that's a great way of trying to reduce your return pressure. Anytime you can get having one big hose that can handle the flow rate is better than having three or four hoses that are trying to fight through hose. If you're fighting heat, that's definitely
and
one
even,
thing that
even
I think
better than a single hose going back is a steel pipe. So, yeah. You know, a lot of times your Cat equipment dealer or your Parker store or whatever, you know, hydraulic supplier you use, they can build you custom steel pipes. They're not cheap, yep. But you can get them built, and we've kind of went through that on a planer we built here. We were looking at getting that done. And, you know, steel is going to dump a lot more heat than a rubber hose will.
It so. Basically makes it into a 30-foot oil cooler.
Yeah.
Without a fan when you go to a steel line.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, gentlemen, I want to know or talk through the best way to diagnose an alternator if I believe it's failing. We have a fair few phone calls every year that typically goes something like, I didn't have a problem in corn, but then I went to soybeans, and when I get to 4.5 mile an hour, all my SRMs drop out. And you'll watch the diagnose screen, and sure enough, voltage just kind of goes until all those SRMs turn red and don't respond. And so you know you have a power issue. How would you guys recommend, or what's kind of the best way to go about, if I'm not getting enough power on a system with an alternator, diagnosing that?
Two tools. Go, Clay.
So two tools that I'm going to show up with to start diagnosing that. First one's going to be a tack. So some sort of a tack. We can pop the PDM off the top of the
like
alternator.
Like you used to put paper on a...
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Thumb tack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So if we can put a tack on the alternator, usually those come with a little piece of reflective tape. Stick that on there, and we can see how fast that alternator is actually spinning. And so we want to make sure that we're over 4,000 RPM on that alternator. If we're not, we've either got to start figuring out, we got to start figuring out where we're losing RPM at. So either we've got a blocked return, we don't have enough supply, or there's something failing with that alternator. So we need to check our input, output pressures. If those both check out, then we've probably got something going on with that alternator motor.
Silly question. Can I put that reflective tape right on the Lovejoy coupler?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very the best good. Place to do it.
Yeah.
Good. All right.
Yep. Yep. So, then the other tool is a flow meter. So that's where we start going into, hey, are we getting enough oil back to that alternator to actually be able to turn it effectively?
Yeah, that flow meter really makes because then you really start to know, okay, how much flow are we actually getting to the alternator? If it's slowing down, why? So if the alternator's slowing down, then the next step's what's the reason why? And the flow meter really becomes the big key to understand why it's slowing down. Like, how much flow are we getting through it? If we're still getting full flow through it, but we're still running slow, that's generally going to indicate you have a bad motor on the alternator.
Or a bad connection, I guess, right. Realistically, somewhere. Yeah. So. Okay. Okay, Clay. If I go on Amazon, can I find a tachometer?
Yeah. You can buy a cheap one.
Okay, perfect. Good one cost me what?
Oh, I think I looked them up. I think they were $20.
You got a brand for me that you like?
Amazon.
I'm putting you right on the spot.
Yeah, I was actually looking at for the flow meter brand that I was going to recommend, but I want to say like that Nico brand.
It's a Nico one, I think, is what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Nico.
Nikeo.
Nikeo. 20713A. They are $20.02 currently on Amazon.
Ain't bad.
You can have it tomorrow even.
If you're a Prime member.
If you're a Prime member, which, you know, around our house, we gotta have somebody swing by each day. So we're big fans of the Amazon Prime.
I think he's a big fan of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I'm grabbing the hydraulic flow meter number here. Give me 1 second.
There's several different ones out there. And what Clay's looking up is one that I would say is well worth spending the money for. We sell one, it works, but if you're really getting into a lot of these systems, I think this is one that, for diagnostic purposes, I really think this is one you should have on hand.
Yeah. So the one that, the one we used in the shop was, it's a HydraCheck brand. So HYDRA Check brand. And this is I'm just going to throw out some numbers here for what we're working with, a 50 gallon per minute. 3,500 PSI reversible flow, which is a difference between ours and this one. This one can go both directions. Ours is not. So 3,500 PSI, 50 gallons per minute is $508. So it is a bit of a spend. But one thing that I talked through in training was what we can do is we can add some sort of a restriction to that flow meter, and we can go out to a customer before we sell him the planner. And we can make sure that, hey, let's put this flow meter in, let's crank up the pressure, and let's let this thing run for a half hour, let it run for an hour. while we're talking through, hey, let's look over the planter, let that thing sit there and run, and we can see, is his tractor actually going to be able to run this new planter that we're talking about? Because I know from experience, it's a way more fun conversation to say, hey, this tractor probably isn't going to work for this planter we're talking about, than it is after the planter's built and he's first day in the field and the tractor won't run the planter. It's a lot more fun conversation to just say, hey, this one isn't going to work. We can go try another one, or maybe we need to look at getting into a different tractor.
I know one other thing I want to pass along. Best website you guys go to for checking specs on tractor hydraulics?
For a lot of times, if I'm just checking tractor hydraulics, there's two that I use. One is the Nebraska Test Lab, and the other one is tractordata.com.
Yep.
Tractordata.com is generally the quickest, easiest way to find something. It's 95% accurate for most of my experiences. And the other 5%, if I really want to know it, Nebraska Test Lab is the one that actually tested it, and that's what it's going to rate at.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the time. Yeah, I appreciate you. I learned a lot. Clay, I wanted to run a couple things by you to do a little market research before we go.
Fent is king.
Okay. Well, table that.
Okay. Wrong direction. Sorry.
You know, again, these March episodes are kind of like around helping out our technicians out there, right? And I think you kind of have the heart of a technician, and you're kind of a road warrior too. You've in the springtime put a lot of miles on the pickup and gone around chasing planters.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I've come up with some topics here that I think maybe for next March we could have an episode on, kind of just for our technicians that are out there on the road quite a bit. And so I just want to run these ideas by you, and you just tell me, is this a podcast episode you would listen to?
Okay.
Now, in your mind, you can kind of picture myself or Hans hosting, and we would have a handful of our different technicians from around the U.S. come on. But ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Best gas station food. You listen to that episode?
Oh, man, I think I would have to listen. Like I said earlier, you know, got some pretty deep-seated opinions already, but I would listen in just to argue in my mind with whoever's telling me that their gas station's better. I would definitely listen in, yeah.
Okay, all right, ready? Next one. Dehydration, beef jerky, and other strategies to avoid multiple bathroom breaks.
Ooh, see, that's dangerous. I was never a great road tech. I didn't get too far from a nice bathroom. I'm kind of a princess like that.
Okay. So maybe you could learn
something. Have something to learn, but man, I've got pretty high standards.
Last one. Top rated treats for the farmer's dog that, quote, doesn't bite.
That's a matter of survival, I think.
Yeah. I've been on top of the service truck before. There's some mean dogs over in Ohio dairy country.
He doesn't bite. No, he's friendly. He don't bite.
Yeah, he looks like it.
He don't bite you.
I'm scrawny. He gets a hold of me. I'm over.
My dad's got a really good story from when he was a fertilizer rep of basically getting out of the truck and the farmer telling him, oh no, don't worry about it. He won't bite. Did he bite you? Sure enough, that dog jumped up and took a big old
chunk right out of it.
My dad's thigh. And the funny thing was, my dad tells the story, and evidently the next night he had a slow pitch softball game that same farmer showed up to, and he had a huge bruise on the back of his leg. And I think the grower was just mortified. Yeah. He's like, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to get bit again, but it wasn't that bad. Gentlemen, the next time that everybody hears from us, we're going to be doing the weekly episodes, passing along what we're hearing, what's driving call volume, and how we can try to help. It's almost that time.
Looking forward to it.
Very good. Thank you guys for the time. For Hans Stetsman, for Clay Scott, I'm Tyler Hubert. Thank you all so much for listening. See you next time.